The plague of Cyprian. I don't know if you've heard of the plague of Cyprian. It's a pandemic that ravaged the Roman Empire from 250 AD to 262 AD, 12 years. At its height, we're told that it wiped out an estimated 5,000 people in Rome every day. Took the lives of two Roman emperors. It actually caused massive manpower shortages in terms of food production in the Roman army. Historians tell us it was so devastating that it almost brought the entire Roman Empire down. Now, in his book, The Rise of Christianity, author Rodney Stark says that Christians played a major role in fighting the plague of Cyprian. See, at a time where the local rulers and physicians would actually leave their town if an outbreak occurred, Christians would stay to help out. And at a time when pagan families would actually kick one of their family members out onto the street, regardless of their age, if they contracted the virus, Christians would take those strangers into their house and care for their needs. And in taking in the affected, many Christians got infected themselves from these strangers, and many Christians died. But as a result of this care from the Christians, Stark estimates that the communities that had no strong Christian presence saw about 30% of their, saw only 10% of their population die. It's an incredible difference. Now, Stark tells us that during this time, people turned to Christianity in their thousands. Their thousands, because of how Christians handled themselves. Attending to the physical needs of others at great personal cost has arguably been the thing that has had the greatest impact on the church and church growth throughout history. Now, we've just come off a month of outreach, Outreach April, where we've been praying, okay, inviting and engaging people in the gospel. Praying, inviting and engaging. And look, the Bible commands these three things, but what history has shown is that the thing that has the greatest impact for the kingdom is when Christians are showing compassion to those people with physical needs. And this is what we see Jesus doing in our passage today. So Matthew chapter 8 starts a new section in Matthew's gospel. You remember last year we looked at the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 to 7. That's Matthew focusing on Jesus' teaching ministry. In chapter 8, he changes his focus to look at Jesus' healing ministry. And what we'll see in our passage today is Jesus' enormous compassion on those who have physical needs. And if we want to literally change the world, like the Christians back in the plague of Cyprian, then we would do well to learn from Jesus in this passage. Now, the beauty of this passage is that Matthew is very clear that you and I cannot do what Jesus is doing here. Okay, we're not the Messiah. And what this passage is, however, saying is that if we are not actively caring for people with physical needs, then we're on a different page to Jesus, because that's what Jesus is interested in, caring for people with physical needs. Jesus literally got his hands dirty in this passage, helping the sick and the troubled, and he wants from his disciples a similar level of compassion for those in need. And look, I've got 4 points today to help us see this. You can see on the inside of your news sheet. So I want to begin by briefly outlining Jesus' purpose in performing these miracles. Why does he do it? Then we're going to zoom in on the two main purposes of Jesus' miracles according to this passage. We're going to look at Jesus' authority, or power, as I've called it in the outline, but really Jesus' authority, and then Jesus' compassion. And we're going to bring it home with some application, which is looking at how we can show the same kind of compassion that Jesus shows here. So if we want to be world-changing Christians, we need to look at Jesus' purpose, Jesus' authority, Jesus' compassion, and then our compassion. So let's dive in. Now, at my Bible study this week, one of the guys asked what I think is the million-dollar question with this passage. Why does Jesus heal these people? What is his purpose behind just going around and healing everyone that comes near him? Well, look, one theory is that it's in Jesus' best interests to do so. So, for example, we see with Peter's mother-in-law, when she's healed, she gets up and waits on them immediately. Is Jesus doing this so he can get meals out of people like this? Sort of a quid pro quo, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. Well, that does happen in the third miracle here, but it doesn't in the second one. Jesus gets nothing from this servant that he heals. He actually never even lays eyes on the guy. So certainly can't be Jesus looking for a returned favour here. The second popular theory is that Jesus heals people to elicit faith, to make them Christian. Now, this is certainly the case in many of Jesus' miracles. We're going to see in the coming weeks in Matthew chapter 9 that Jesus literally says to people, your faith has healed you, or don't worry, just believe. So Jesus is very interested in making disciples, okay? But not in this passage, strangely enough. Now, yes, the leper believes Jesus can heal him, and the centurion blows Jesus away with his faith. But there's no mention of the sick servant's faith. I mean, like I said, Jesus never even lays eyes on the guy. And he heals Peter's mother-in-law without any reference to faith either. So faith is not the underlying issue for this passage. Perhaps it's so Jesus can get people to stop bugging him. You know, if I do this for you, will you go away and leave me alone? Well, that doesn't add up either, because every time Jesus heals someone, it attracts more attention to himself. The reason he tells the man with leprosy to tell no one in verse 4 is so that he won't be swamped by even more crowds. In fact, when we look in the Gospels, every time someone ignores Jesus' command to tell no one, what ends up happening is Jesus just gets mobbed by more and more people. He can't actually go into a town anymore. He has to stay out in the desert places. So avoiding more hassles can't be Jesus' purpose, because that actually brings more hassles. As I said in the beginning, there's two important purposes for Jesus' healing in this passage, which are our next two points. The first is it displays his authority, and the second is it shows his compassion. Displays his authority and shows his compassion. We're going to look at those in order. And we see Jesus' authority in the ease at which he heals these people. You see, when you hear of other people healing, now, it could be like ancient sort of legends or fables, or even modern day sort of fairy tale stories or movies. If someone's going to heal someone else miraculously, what do? They do things like they wave a wand, or they speak some sort of magic spell, or they cook up some sort of magic potion, right? Even the Old Testament prophets would have to do things like they would get on their knees and pray. One guy had to go and wash himself 7 times in the Jordan, or they'd just call upon the power of God, okay? Not Jesus. Right? All Jesus does is he touches the man with leprosy, or he grabs his Peter's mother-in-law by the hand. That's it. And they're healed. In fact, the middle episode that we looked at, Jesus doesn't even touch the person. So when Jesus offers to go to the house of this Gentile, we read in verse 8, have a look. The centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. Now, the reason Jesus is amazed by this guy is because Jesus has done nothing in his ministry so far to even remotely give the impression that he can heal someone from a distance. So to make a statement like this, it shows that this centurion knows that Jesus does not have just normal everyday authority. He has divine authority. And by divine authority, I mean he's not bound by proximity. He has authority over the whole world. He can just say a word and some guy that he's never met, in some place that he's never stepped foot in, with some disease that he cannot possibly diagnose, will just be healed like that. And the reason Matthew wants to focus on Jesus' authority in this passage is to show that Jesus' message from the previous passage is authentic. Now, we see this in verse 4. Briefly, have a look. He says, says to the man, go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift of Moses, the gift that Moses commanded, as a testimony to them. And what is this testimony? It is that Jesus has divine authority. Right? Leprosy was incurable in the first century. If you got leprosy, that was a death sentence. The only way this guy could have been cured is if someone who had God's authority had stepped in. And that is Jesus. And if Jesus has God's authority, then we need to sit up and pay attention to what he says. Now, it's no coincidence that this passage about authority comes straight after the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is arguably, the hardest-hitting sermon ever given. All right, love your enemies. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Turn the other cheek. Or judge not, lest you be judged. But here's the thing. That's not the real offense of the Sermon on the Mount. The real offense of the Sermon on the Mount comes when Jesus says that entry into heaven is not based on your good deeds. It's based on your relation to Jesus. All right? It's on the page there. Just look at chapter 7, verse 22. This is Jesus saying, "Many will come to me on that day saying, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and drive out demons in your name and perform many miracles?' Then I," this is Jesus, "will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" Now, how is it that Jesus can make such claims? How is it that Jesus can say, your entry into heaven is based on your relationship to me? Well, it's because he's God. And Jesus shows that he is God through his divine authority in this world. Only God can heal with a touch, and only God can heal with a word. And so the first reason Jesus performs these miracles, and this is why Matthew is pointing them out here, is to show that when Jesus says entry into heaven is contingent on how you respond to me, then he's telling the truth. We need to sit up and listen. Second reason Jesus performs these healings is seen in the last verse, verse 17. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and bore our diseases. And that comes from Isaiah chapter 53. And what Matthew is saying is these healings are there to fulfill Isaiah 53. And Isaiah 53 is the suffering servant passage. All right, so familiar to many of us. Let me read to you the verse straight after the one that Matthew quotes here. So this is Isaiah 53, verse 5. It says, "For he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed." Now, the interesting thing is commentators are split as to exactly how Jesus' healings of people is the fulfillment of Isaiah 53. Now, the complicated factor comes because the context of Isaiah 53 is Jesus healing us of our sin, right? So the cross. So how is it that Jesus' healing ministries are a fulfillment of what happened on the cross? What is the connection between the cross and these healing ministries? Now, we're going to need our thinking caps on for about a minute to understand this connection. And again, commentators are split on this. I think the answer that best fits the context here is the context of substitution. Right? What I mean is this. The main point of Isaiah 53 is that Jesus substituted himself for us. He says, "By his wounds we are healed." Now, what does that mean? It's like a paramedic turning up to to help an injured person, right? And, everyone's crowded around, and the paramedic says, "Look, in order to heal this injured person on the ground, I need to stab one of you innocent bystanders." Makes no sense physically, does it? But spiritually, right, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. The whole point of Isaiah 53 is that Jesus became punished for us. You see, even though you and I deserve to be punished for our transgressions, for our iniquities, Jesus took our place in that. Now, how does this relate to healing? All right, stay with me for another 20 seconds. See, while he was on earth, Jesus healed every sick person he came into contact with. In fact, one commentator, B.B. Warfield, says, death and disease, he goes so far as saying, death and disease were banished from Palestine for the duration of Jesus' ministry. Now, I think that's probably a bit of a stretch, okay? But what he's getting at is that Jesus hated disease. He hated seeing people that were sick or in need. And every time he came across that, he worked to fix it. But what's more is the book of Revelation says that one day Jesus will have fixed it for good. And that's what he's doing at the moment. He's working towards that day when death and disease will be gone for good. But in order to make that happen, Jesus had to become weak. Jesus had to become human. And this is where the substitution comes in. To fight death and disease in Palestine some 2,000 years ago, and to one day eradicate death and disease for good, Jesus had to become human and suffer a human death. Now, why would a God do that? Why would a divine being choose to willingly suffer a human death? Well, it can only be because he cares about his creatures. Right? Jesus so wants death and disease taken away for good that he was willing to step in and make the ultimate sacrifice to do it. Now, this poses a final question. What about us? Where do we fit in? See, if Jesus was willing not just to risk his all, but give his all to eradicate death and disease for you and me, right? Then what are we willing to do for God in this department? Because here's the thing, Jesus died, he gave his all for the people in this room. Now that shows that he loves the people in this room. And so the way we can love Jesus is by also loving the people that he loves. And so the question we need to ask is, what lengths are we willing to go to show the kind of compassion to people in this room and all around us based on the fact that that's what Jesus did for us? Well, there are a couple of things that we can do by way of application when it comes to looking after people's physical needs. And I'll start by saying this is the one that Aussies prefer to do the most, and that is by giving our money. The thing Aussies would prefer to do to help those in need is to give money to a charity and say to that charity, can you please go and use this money for good? But here's the thing, even with that, Aussies are not that great. There's statistics that I got from 2016. We don't have 2019 stats yet, of course. But in 2016, the average wage in Australia was about $80,000, give or take. The average amount that the Aussie adult gave to charity that year was $666. Now, that's less than 1%. That's like 0.75, 0.8% of our average wage. Those in the higher tax bracket actually gave a smaller percentage to charity that year. Friends, if we want to be Christians like Christ, then we Christians need to do better with our giving of money to charity. But instead of just throwing money at the problem, Christians are called to give their time too. One of the famous passages in the Bible on this is the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan gave up almost an entire day of his time to look after a stranger. Let me tell you, I love hearing about our parishioners who give lifts to our fellow church members if they need to go to the hospital or the doctors or to do something else. I love hearing that. We can go visit people in hospital, right? Huge help for people who are in hospital. We can help out with their laundry or their groceries or mow their lawn if they're sick or suffering. Right? There's many practical ways that we can spend our time to show Christ-like compassion to others. Well, then there's our comfort. We can actually get our hands dirty. Now, the thing about the parable of the Good Samaritan is the Good Samaritan physically picked up that mugging victim and physically washed his wounds. Now, for me, I didn't go into medicine, because I didn't have the marks, but B, it was gross doing things like that. But here's the thing. If that's what they need, then that's what Jesus wants us to do. He wants us to actually get our hands dirty. Have you ever shaken hands with a homeless person? That's the kind of thing he wants us to do. To step out of our comfort zone and physically help people with what they need. So we're to give our money, we're to give our time, we're to give our comfort, and finally, if needed, we're to give our safety. See, the thing that made people pour into the kingdom of God back during the plague of Cyprian was not just that Christians helped the sick, it was that Christians helped the sick knowing that they might die in the process. And many of them did. Well, are we willing to risk our health, our safety, even our life to look after God's beloved creatures? And if we're not, then we need to just focus our attention again on what Jesus gave up for us. He didn't just risk his all, he gave it because he loves you. Friends, I began today by saying that nothing has changed the world more for Christ than Christians looking after the physical needs of others, even at great personal risk. And look, here's the thing, it's not just the wider witness, all right? Actively engaging in social justice ministries gives us an opportunity to talk to Jesus with the people we're helping as well. But what I want to close today with is by emphasizing Jesus' motivation in this passage. And Jesus' motivation in this passage is not making converts. Did you know that? Not one person became a Christian and turned to Christ in this passage. Jesus didn't even ask. And what that shows is Jesus cares about these people's physical well-beings as well. Now, that's not to say that Jesus isn't interested in spiritual well-being. The rest of this chunk that we're going to be looking at is talking about that, but not this passage. He shows that he has compassion on people's physical needs, and he works to help them. I want to close with a story that, that James told me this week. He got it from a book that he read called Onward, Engaging the Culture Without Losing the Gospel. And in this book, the author, Russell Moore, talks about a group home near his church that is specifically designed to look after kids with severe cognitive disabilities. And so members of his church will regularly go into that group home. They'll brush the kids' hair. They will sing to them. They'll just sit and hold their hands. Now, here's the thing. Those kids have zero ability to respond to the gospel. Many of them don't even know that the church people are there. So if they have zero ability to make converts of these children, is that ministry worth it for a church? The answer is, you bet it is. You bet it is. For those children are God's creatures whom he loves. And if we do not show compassion to them, then we're on a different page to Jesus. So friends, if Jesus was willing to become weak for us, may we too become weak for others. May we give of our money, may we give of our time, may we give of our comfort, and may we give of our health and safety if need be, to show Christ-like compassion to those in need.